History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are always stories out there that should not go untold. Our mission is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we go down that road, we're always better off for it. We're educated, we're entertained, often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'll remember to share some exciting news on the education piece of that a little bit later, but today we have the chance to hear the kind of story that for decades we didn't think we'd ever hear. Another historic warship discovered at the bottom of the ocean nearly 77 years after it was sunk, but found now while a few survivors of its sinking still remain. The late Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen commissioned the research vessel Petrel to hunt for World War II ships lost at sea. The son of a World War II veteran, Allen was still alive when the Petrel discovered the USS Indianapolis, which had delivered the components of the atomic bomb before it was torpedoed by the Japanese, leading to the worst shark attack in recorded history. He also got to revel in the discovery of another cruiser, the USS Helena, in Iron Bottom Sound off of Guadalcanal, and the aircraft carrier USS Lexington, which had been lost in the Battle of the Coral Sea in 1942. Allen passed away in October after a courageous fight with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but the crew of the Petrel has continued that quest to locate historic ships. And last month, the Petrel announced the discovery of the aircraft carrier USS Hornet, which had famously launched the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo in April of 1942, but was sunk in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands 6 months later. CBS News had exclusive access aboard the Petrel during the quest to locate the Hornet, and you can watch some of that video at hometownheroesradio.com. It includes a survivor of the Hornet laying eyes on his ship for the first time in three quarters of a century. There are still a handful of Hornet survivors left, and we have the privilege of hearing from one today on Hometown Heroes. Iowa native Bob Cole is 96 now. He was just 19 when he was wounded during the attack on the Hornet. We had the privilege of showing Bob some of the images from the carrier's wreckage, including a 5-inch gun like the one he used to sit under. Now it's 3.5 miles deep on the ocean floor.
You know, 3.5 miles down, that's a long way down there. When I have my regular duties, I sit on the 5-inch gun, you know, the seat, and watch for, at night, watch to see if any lights are on or anything, to spot anything, that, like sand pans and all that. And not only that, at night, by Doolittle, the pilots and all they would come out to stretch. And they were told, you don't light up any cigarettes. Because they can see that light for miles. But I got a chance to meet them, you know, and talk to them, see how, you know, about their family lives and all that.
And so when you would sit on one of those 5-inch guns, that's what you were looking for, was lights in the distance?
On my side, yeah.
What is it like to look at pictures of your ship right now, 77 years almost after it sunk?
77, yeah.
What does that feel like to see it?
Well, you know, it really makes me reminisce of what that many years that this happened.
Have you ever wondered over the years if they'd ever find it?
No. No, because I've talked to other people at the Veterans Hospital, and they're on different ships, not aircraft carriers, but like destroyers or something like that. And they always wondered if their ship would ever be found, and then they gave up on it.
So you had pretty much given up too then, probably,
Oh, yeah, I had. Well, my daughter-in-law called me and said, hey, they found your ship. I said, what are you talking about? She said, no, they found your ship and it was 3.5 miles down.
Hard to believe. Incredible, but true. You can find a video of Bob looking at some of those scenes from 3.5 miles down at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When the Petrel found those other ships, we heard from survivors of each one of them here on this program, and it was fun to go back and listen to our original interview with Bob from 2013. One of the things we talked about was what he would look for if he could hypothetically go back aboard his sunken ship. We'll get to that, but to get the full context of this remarkably resilient man's story, let's go back to his hometown of Odo, Iowa.
How big is Odo, Iowa?
300 people.
Wow, that's a big city.
Two stop signs.
What was life growing up for you in Odo, Iowa?
Well, it was pretty poor, and you had to play basketball and baseball, but no football because you didn't have enough people, not enough boys. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go to college, and I ended up joining the Navy because they said I get a year of college for every year I'm in the service. So I signed up for 4 years.
And this was before Pearl Harbor?
Before. This is in August of 41.
Why the Navy as opposed to another branch of the service? Was it because you didn't have much water around Odo, Iowa, or what?
Well, two reasons. One, because only the Navy recruiter came to our school, and I believed in, if I'm going to go to war, I want to ride, not walk.
And did you understand from the things that were going on in the world at that point, was it clear to you that maybe America would be at war sometime soon?
Didn't have any speculation at all that wars. All I was interested in is get my 4 years in and get go to college. But lo and behold, it happened.
Not exactly the way you planned it. And so you join in August of 41, and they take you from a city of 300 to Great Lakes Training Station, which is just outside one of the biggest cities in the world there.
I mean, I'm going to comment on that. The largest building we have in Odo was a grain elevator. We get Liberty out of Great Lakes, and I got in Chicago, and I was on Michigan Avenue, and all of a sudden a drawbridge goes up, and I'm standing there in awe, seeing the Tribune building, and horns are honking at me, get out of the street. I almost got run over because I couldn't believe this bridge going up and a boat going through.
A lot bigger than a grain elevator, huh?
Oh, man, I tell you.
So it was a real eye-opener for you.
Real eye-opener. And then when I graduated from the Great Lakes, they sent me to Norfolk, Virginia, on board an aircraft carrier Hornet, CV-8, by the way, because CV-12 was in a museum in Oakland now, you know.
What was your first impression of the CV-8, the Hornet? How big a ship was that? That's probably bigger than Odo.
Well, when I went aboard there, we had 3,000 people, 3,000 sailors, mm-hmm. And that was a culture shock, coming from 300 people to 3,000 people, and seeing this great big ship. The only thing I ever seen was a little boat going down the river. And so we didn't have any airplanes, you know, because all the airplanes were, when they did get on there, were propeller-driven and not jets. And we didn't have any guns when war broke out, and so we hadn't even been commissioned yet.
Well, that begs the question, what do you remember about when the war did break out? Where were you on December 7th, 1941, and how'd you hear about it?
I was in Norfolk, Virginia, on board the aircraft carrier, and we heard it from our captain over the loudspeaker. Then afterwards, you know, the news flashes all over, so we heard it from the radios also. From there, we went, got all our stuff in a hurry, and they shipped us to, went through the Panama Canal and went to the West Coast in Alameda, and that's where we picked up Doolittle and his airplanes.
Yeah, this is pretty historic stuff, but I'm curious what it felt like to you as a young man, because here you are, I guess you would have been 19 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. You're away from home. You're on this aircraft carrier, and all of a sudden now there's a war going on. What did that do to you emotionally, mentally? How did you process that?
First thing we did, we all gathered around and prayed in our own department and hoped for the best of us. And to me, I never experienced anything like this before. I never, you know, I read about World War One, but I never visualized we're going to be in a war. And I thought this is going to be 4 years of, like the Navy says, come and join the Navy and see the world. And I didn't get to see the world very much.
Not all the parts you wanted to see anyway. And give us a sense of what your duties on the ship were.
I was a storekeeper, and what we did was did the payroll for the sailors on board. We also operated the, what they call a concession stand, where the crew could come in and buy candy or ice cream, cigarettes. By the way, cigarettes were 3 cents a pack. It was no taxes. And I didn't smoke, so that was my duties as payroll and helping run the concession stand for the crew.
It probably made you a pretty popular guy on that ship.
Oh yeah. Because we weren't open very often, you know, maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, and different people would run it. I enjoyed every bit of it.
So you mentioned going through the Panama Canal and then around to the West Coast, and you picked up Doolittle and his pilots. Now, this was just unheard of at the time. Everything they were doing was crazy. The deck was not designed to have B-25s fly off it. They had to modify the B-25s to get them to take off in such a short distance. But I'm curious what you guys, as a crew of that ship, knew about this whole thing. What did you see happening, and what were you starting to figure out?
Well, at first we didn't know we were going to go to Japan. We just knew that they told we have a mission. They're not going to say anything because they didn't want anybody to know what we're doing. And so all we knew is we were taking them to some place, and after we left the United States, we found out where we were going. We weren't too excited about that. You know, going to war, are we going to last my 4 years or what? What if I get sunk?
Those questions would be answered eventually. Was there a buzz on this ship about these 16 airplanes and these pilots and crews that were aboard?
Very much so, especially when we got to Alameda and they found out what we were going to do. Like you say, number one, how are they going to fly off this thing? Because there's no jets or anything like that. And so it was a buzz. I mean, it was really talked about, hoping that whatever mission we're on, that would be a good one.
And I think pretty much everyone in every theater of the war had their mail censored. But were you guys given specific instructions not to say anything about this development?
That's right. We told everything. Don't you write back home or anything like that. Don't mention anything about it. Just carry on a conversation, a normal one. We make sure we wrote home and told them that we're alive, but we couldn't tell them what our missions were, though.
There's a lot of material that's been written about the Doolittle Raid. There are movies that have been made. And one thing that I've always found interesting was the timing of the whole thing. And it's somewhat similar to D-Day, where the timing they planned wasn't the timing that happened. And they ended up leaving early because they thought the Japanese had spotted them. Did you experience any of what was going on there when they actually took off? Did people find out? Did you see them taking off?
One of my guard duties at night was to man the 5-inch cannon and also look out the night and see if he saw anything. And then the pilots would come out and visit us. They can't smoke because of a little teeny light would be seen. And also we were told that we were going to go within 600 miles of Japan, Tokyo. But at 800 miles, they spotted the sampans. And we knew the sampans had walkie-talkies, or whatever you want to call it. So that's when they had to adjust their plan. So instead of taking off at 600 miles in Tokyo, they took off at around 800 miles of Tokyo. We're on what they call general quarters. And so in my case, I didn't get a chance to see them take off because my general quarters were different from my regular yard duty. So we didn't get to see them take off at all.
But I'm sure you heard about it.
Oh, yeah. We heard those big, I mean, they're a lot louder than a little F-16 or an SB bomber taking off by the...
You hear those two engines of the B-25 going, and you know something's happening. Do you remember, and maybe this wasn't the case, but were people speculating aboard ship on what might happen to these planes and whether they thought they'd make it where they were going? Did anyone have any idea what they were doing?
No one knew, and I don't think anybody expected them to be... anybody come back alive, because if, you know, ground fire... Did they have enough gas go all the way to where we didn't know where their destination was after they did their bombing? So
they didn't really know either.
No, that's right. That's right.
That's what makes that story so incredible, that these pilots and these crew members really did sign up for a suicide mission, not knowing where they'd be able to land, if they'd be treated well. And it's amazing that that they did as well as they did. When you've heard that story over the years, what's been the most impressive or inspiring aspect to you about all those planes and what they were able to do and the fact that so many of them did make it?
Well, it really, when we learned about it, you know, because they told us, the captain came over with a loudspeaker and told us all these things that happened. They didn't know, you know, 100%, but they told them that so far it's 75% good so far. Uh-huh. Now it's 80% good so far. And then they told us about a couple of them didn't, you know, I don't know how many went, didn't make it, but I read the story, so we were very elated on the outcome.
So I imagine somewhere in that announcement on the loudspeaker, he said, those B-25s bombed Tokyo.
Yeah, they bombed Tokyo, and most of them made it out of there all right, and they're on their own. There was a few casualties, and, you know, made us feel real good that we had a part of it.
And the way history remembers that raid is not so much that the actual physical damage was a huge blow, but that the emotional power of what happened there was significant, not just to the Japanese, who now suddenly felt vulnerable, but to America to say, you know what, you hit Hawaii, well, we hit Tokyo. What did that feel like for you guys on the ship after having experienced Pearl Harbor, knowing what happened there, to hear some of our planes just bomb Tokyo?
Well, we felt real good about it because not the eye for eye or tooth for tooth business, but the idea that if you attacked us, you're going to pay for it one way or another. And this is a good example of how we were payback time.
So that's how Bob experienced it. You've probably heard a bit about the famous Doolittle raid on Tokyo, launched from the deck of the Hornet on April 18th, 1942. And, of course, America learned about it through the newspapers, on the radio, and from newsreels. So let's take a time machine back to 1942, if we can. You might have seen this newsreel from Castle Films, the headline, Yanks Bomb Tokyo, and the commentator, Basil Rysdale.
Packed on the after deck of the Hornet are 16 B-25 Mitchell bombers. Never before have these huge planes been launched from a carrier. Not until they are miles at sea do these men know definitely the mission for which they have volunteered. And now the signal is flashed for the takeoff, 10 hours ahead of schedule. Doolittle pilots the lead plane. There's a breathless moment as the big bomber gathers speed. It's airborne. The first Army bomber ever to be launched from a carrier is safely in the air. Now they know it can be done, and they time their takeoff with the upsurge of the bow of the carrier in the heavy sea. The defense system, as they practice it here, proved disorganized and panic-stricken when Doolittle and his men catch them flat-footed. Not a single shell fragment hit a plane. The loss of face by Tokyo may well have driven the Japs into the disastrous Midway expedition and its staggering losses of ships and men. Later, in China, the flyers who bailed out safely are decorated by Madame Chiang Kai-shek. The smiling Jimmy Doolittle does not yet know the fate of some of his comrades.
No, he didn't. He would learn later that 11 men were killed or captured by the Japanese, 3 of them executed in captivity. All of the aircraft, of course, were lost, but the emotional blow, the symbolism of that unexpected strike, carried great value for America and its allies. Doolittle, who once feared that he may be court-martialed as a failure, was awarded our nation's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. Bob Cole once posed for a photo with Jimmy Doolittle aboard the Hornet.
Sad part of it is I had a lot of pictures taken with the pilots. I had a picture taken with General Doolittle, and I lost them all when the ship went down.
You had that film in your locker.
I had a film in my locker, plus my $2, plus all my clothes.
Was there anything else that you want to say about Doolittle and that raid and what it means to you still today?
You know, I feel honored that I had a little tiny bit to do with that raid, just a tiny bit, because all the things should go toward Doolittle and their crew and how they all the time they spent practicing how to go off an aircraft or someplace else. I think that was great for their part.
The thing that wasn't so great for you, they were gone, and they had their own survival things to deal with. But what they did made your ship a target. The Japanese knew the aircraft carrier that had launched those planes, and that meant there was a bigger price tag on the Hornet's head than just about anybody else. Did you guys realize that at the time, that you were marked?
No. You know, it's quite an incident, because out there where we got sunk, we weren't the only aircraft carrier got sunk out there.
We'll hear about that day that nearly ended his life and more on what the discovery of the Hornet here in 2019, 77 years after its sinking, means to this now 96-year-old. Check out the photos and video online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to reconnect with a veteran we met years ago on this program now that his ship, the aircraft carrier USS Hornet, has been discovered by the research vessel Petrel 3.5 miles deep on the ocean floor. It was late October 1942 in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands that the carrier was sunk. 140 of the ship's crew of 2,200 lost their lives that day. Then 19-year-old Bob Cole was one of many more to be wounded.
My job during the battle is we were on the second floor in the forward mess hall. And what we did was put the bomb, the vanes and fuses on the bombs and send them up to the hangar deck or flight deck. I don't know if you want me to go on for that.
Yeah, I don't think very many people have put fuses on bombs, especially not during a war on an aircraft carrier. So I think you have a pretty unique story to tell there.
This is on the second deck in the forward mess hall. There were 35 of us down there in that mess hall, and we chipped up the elevator as fast as we could. And what happened, the bombers, Japanese bombers came off the island of Guadalcanal, which they own, and they just kept bombing us and bombing us. We didn't have kamikazes hit us. They hit right at the flight deck and hit where the motors and all that, the control tower is. And one of the bombs came right down the elevator where we were and exploded. And the shrapnel from the mess tables hit me right in the eye, right here. And they cut my eye down, lowered my eye down, so I lost my eye, my vision and everything else. And we lost the elevator, and out of that 35, only 12 of us came out alive. I don't know why. And then all of a sudden, we over the loudspeaker, it says, abandoned ship, abandoned ship. And I don't know where we're going to get up there. So we crawled up the ladders to the hangar deck, and then we had to jump into the water. And I happened to find a towel to hold my eye up like this, because it was just laying down by the skin underneath here, and an optic nerve that held it from just going out altogether. And I had two big holes in my back from the shrapnel. So we abandoned ship, and I stayed in the water for about 45 minutes to an hour before I was rescued, because, you know, all the people were abandoning. The destroyer, Mustang, came up and picked me up. Then they took me into the dressing room, and they sewed my eye up with no anesthetic, so I was in such a shock. From there, they took me to the French island called Noumea. Also, we had a hospital ship, Solace, S-O-L-A-C-E, and I was put aboard there. And that's when they were determined what to do with my eye. They weren't worried about my back, and my back hurt more than the eye. But 3 days on board the ship, hospital ship, there was a cargo ship going back to San Diego. So we drew straws who was going to go back. I happened to draw a good straw. There were some married couples there. Married people wanted to go. Says, I'll give you $5,000 for that. I said, well, I'll never see you again, buddy. I may be dumb, but I'm not stupid. So I went back to, but took us about, I think it was 2 weeks or so before we got to San Diego. And then we put in the San Diego Naval Hospital. And I stayed there for almost 8 months. My parents were given a letter saying I was a MIA, you know, missing in action, because nobody knew where we were, you know, everything's in uproar.
Man, there's so many questions about this. I didn't want to interrupt you because it's so captivating, the story that you told. But I'm going to backtrack with you and kind of take you through some of those steps along the way. So at the time that you guys got hit, you were on that second deck putting fuses on bombs?
Yeah, putting a fuse and bomb and vanes on the bomb. And then we'd ship them up in the elevator to the hangar deck or flight deck, probably the hangar deck first, because they couldn't put the planes on the hangar deck up to the flight deck until the planes on the flight deck took off. And then
and all of a sudden this explosion happens.
Bomb came right down the elevator, which we used to go up and down and ship the bombs, and they exploded. And had to be in the Ford mess hall. The tables are all aluminum or something like that. And they just scattered and then shrapnel hit every all of us.
So all of the explosive material and shrapnel within the bomb was added to by all this metal material inside the room. I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes and understand what that felt like. Because, I mean, this is sudden and intense, I imagine. What did it feel like?
You know, I was in shock. Looking around and also seeing how, you know, we told you to abandon ship, find out where the ladder was, because I, you know, I'm not normal. And then seeing some of my good friends dead and find out where the other ones who were not dead, so we all could go up, you know, one at a time, the ladder. And it's, you know, it's chaos.
And your left eye is hanging out of the socket, just hanging on by a thread.
By the skin underneath and an optic nerve, one optic nerve there.
You're wounded in the back.
When they took the shrapnel out of the holes in my back, whatever the utensils they use, they could see my rib. Yeah.
You had to be in a lot of pain.
Oh, well, when you're in shock, you don't know what I was in pain, very much so. Then I had to jump in the water.
Well, you had to get up to where you can jump in the water first. And
also, I had to find a life jacket.
And you probably can't see very straight with only one eye.
That's right. Blood just rolling all over the place. There, your camaraderie is great because people are helping each other. They grabbed me, you know, and led me to where I'm supposed to jump, and we jumped together so I wouldn't go someplace else.
That's not a jump in a wading pool.
They say it's around between 40 and 60 feet. And thank God I wasn't on the flight deck. So that's higher up.
Yeah. Did you have to hold your eye in while you jumped?
I did because I had a towel. I found a towel when I was there, and there was some guy might have found it for me. And I lift my eye back up and then hold the towel like that and held it all the time I was there. And they said, make sure when you do get in the water, make sure you float on your back, because your back has more protection than your stomach does. Your stomach is just so fat.
And this may sound like a dumb question or a dumb series of questions. Were you scared? Did you think you were going to die?
Very scared, very scared. You know, I've never been through anything like that. I'm a little farm boy. Never even had guns around our house or anything like that, so I don't think about, you talk about a life lesson. I probably learned more the 4 years I was in the Navy than I learned 4 years in college about life. I'm not talking about books now. I'm talking about life. I learned everything. I learned things I never even envisioned I'd ever know. You know, or have to do, or, but that's, I'm not the only one, you know.
The phrase trial by fire takes on new meaning when we hear a story like yours. So you've gotten out of the fire, out of this sinking ship, but now you're in the water, and there are all kinds of things to worry about in the water. How long were you in the water?
Anywhere from about 45 minutes to an hour.
How long did it feel like?
Eternity. But I looked around, I said, I'm not here by myself. That's the best part of it. If I had to be there by myself, I might have just turned over and said, the heck with it.
How many did you have with there? Do you remember any of them?
On our ship, because there's a lot of ships out there picking up people out of the water. I would say it was about 20 in my particular area.
Did you have anything to help you stay afloat?
Yeah, your life jacket, that's all. That's all. And, you know, you paddle, dog paddle or something like that.
And I want to get back to your story and how you recovered and all that, but how often over the years, and it's been more than 70 years since this happened, how often do you think about those shipmates of yours who didn't make it?
At first, I didn't think too much about it because I was thinking about myself. In fact, after I came back and went through college and I was teaching, they thought I had post-trauma, and they sent me to a psychiatry and all that, even after when I was teaching. And, I feel sorry for those people, but life goes on, you know. And I met other people because after I got out of the hospital, I had another adventure. Because what they wanted to do was give me a medical discharge out of the hospital. And I said, no, I don't want one, because I signed up for 4 years because I want a college education. And this is the only way I'm going to get it. So I don't want a discharge. So they put on my papers that I could never be shipped outside the continental limits of the United States. So I was put on recruiting duty. I was sent to St. Louis and recruiting aviation cadets. I never thought about teaching. You know, because I was a social studies major and a PE minor, and I was put in St. Louis. We live in private homes. I go out to in Missouri, Kentucky, Indiana, recruiting at the high schools, just like that guy recruited me.
And this is while the war is still going on.
Oh, the war is still going on, yeah. And I recruited aviation cadets. To when the recruiting was closed up, I was sent to St. Olaf College in Northville, Minnesota. Anybody know about Northville? That's where Jesse James robbed the bank. Anyway, in this small town south of Minneapolis, there's two colleges. St. Olaf is for Navy cadets. On the other side of the river was the Carleton College for Army cadets. And so I was sent to St. Olaf, and that's where I taught English and math. I didn't know I wanted to be a teacher, but by recruiting and going to all these high schools and teaching there, and then when that closed up, I was sent to Miami, Florida, Opa-locka Air Station. It's quite a coincidence, talking about Miami. There was a hurricane coming in, so we had to take our papers with us and stay in a hotel until the hurricane was over. Then I stayed at Opa-locka Air Station, and when my 4 years was up, I said, it's time to go.
Well, that's impressive that that college education meant that much to you, that they're giving you your discharge. You said, no, I want to serve some more. And I'm curious, when you're out there recruiting guys, the war's still going on. In fact, the war's getting worse and worse if you look at it from a casualty perspective. How often did you talk about what had happened to you?
Well, I give them the whole story, like what happened to me. And I said that, but remember, my story is only one. And here's a chance for you to do what I meant to do. I want to go to college. Now, here's a chance for you to go to get a free college education, learn to be a pilot. Because if you do survive the war, most of the pilots go on to be pilots for United, you know, all the airlines.
So would you say you were a pretty good recruiter then?
Oh, I thought so, because we had a lot of them.
So none of them ever said, hey, it almost killed you. Why do I want to go do that?
No, they didn't say that.
As far as the recovery, so, I mean, you get picked up. You know, maybe I didn't spend enough time on that. How great did that feel to get picked up out of that water?
I thought they were never coming. Look, there's, 3,000 people in the water. Count the other ships and all that people. How can they handle so many people? I thought, well, when I saw that ship coming towards us, we all hollered, hey, over here, over here. You know, you've seen that on TV, haven't you? Uh-huh. Hey, over here, I'm over here.
Best thing you ever saw?
Oh, man, better than ice cream.
And unexpected emotions are being stirred again here in 2019 with the discovery of his sunken ship, the USS Hornet. Break time again, but when we come back, more on the injuries he suffered 77 years ago and what meaningful adventure he's going to be taking off on next month. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Just a heads up, if you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find not only a video with Bob Cole, from whom we're hearing on this program, but also the CBS News piece with his fellow Hornet survivor, Richard Nowatzky, and other links related to the discovery of the aircraft carrier that launched the Doolittle Raid 77 years ago, the USS Hornet. Here's another related note on recent events. Just a couple of weeks ago in Missoula, Montana, the VA clinic there was renamed in honor of David Thatcher, a Doolittle Raider who shared his story on Hometown Heroes long ago. You can link to that interview online as well. In a moment, we're going to hear more of 96-year-old Bob Cole's thoughts on that long-lost ship being found by the research vessel Petrel. But first, more on what he went through in 1942.
You talked about being in shock when that bomb hit and you're hit in the back and your eyes hanging out. When did that shock wear off, and when did you realize what had happened to you?
I think the shock wore off was when I was on board the hospital ship Solis. They had, more trained doctors, because when you're on board, like that destroyer, and you're moving, and you're the guy operator, you know, he's trying to do the best he can, but you're still under fire, and you're moving. And so when I was aboard the Solis, the hospital ship, you know, they're standing still. They're not moving. In fact, they wanted to take my eye out and give me a glass eye. Thank God that cargo ship came along. Because what am I going to say? But they know more medically than I do. And so I figured whatever they say is going to happen. So I was very fortunate that I still have my same eye. But little by little, I can distinguish day and night. And once in a while I can see a hand, but if you put one or two or three, I would never see that. So
you see fine out of your right eye, but the left eye has never been the same since.
No, and the right eye is, that's why I go to the Veterans Hospital here every 4 months, and they give me, I put drops in my eye, and DMV wants 20/40, but the best I can get is 20/50. And the DMV say, that's good enough for me. Uh-huh. So far.
Well, I know you covered a lot of miles all those years of refereeing and basketball, and that I have to go there because it's too ripe for the picking. What is the biggest criticism about referees every year, that they need glasses or they can't see? Did you ever have some people heckle you about your basketball reffing?
I said, hey, I got both eyes, but I only see out of one. And then a lot of times they razz you, and then I might say, I'm laughing all the way to the bank.
If they only knew what that eye had been through, that it would be heaping coals on top of their heads, I'm sure.
Most of the coaches, you know, we might meet at the bar, mm-hmm. and we have good times. And I remember one time when I met at the bar, and I put my glasses on, and this coach's wife says, why the hell didn't you put those glasses on while you're refereeing? I said, I might have seen too much and caused the game to go longer.
Yeah, we don't want that whistle blowing too much. So you said, was it 8 months in the hospital?
8 months. There's a comic side of that, too, you know, because I had both eyes covered all the time because they didn't want to have the strain on one eye. But if you wanted liberty whenever you're able, you had to do one or two things. You either polish all the brass in your area or go to the zoo and clean out the zoo pens. I said, well, I'm not going to the zoo. I've been in the zoo all my life. Out in that water, that's the zoo. Yeah. So I didn't go much liberty. No, either that or I just polished the brass.
8 months is a long time, and your back's healing up, your eyes healing up. What was the hardest thing for you to deal with?
Well, I told you before this, you know, I never had a chance to call my mother to let her know where I am because I knew I was listed as MIA. When I was able to get to the phone, when they allowed me to use the phone, I called my mom and told her, she's in shock because I hadn't heard anything from me.
She thought you were dead.
Yeah. In fact, they had a funeral for me. That was before I called her. And I called her and she's, oh, God. Well, she had a sister living in Glendale. And so she immediately called her sister, and her sister came down and visited me once a month. That was something, but you know, it was lonely. You lay there and you can't see because your both eyes are covered. In fact, when I was going to college and my wife and I was all covered, and I had a biology class and I had to trace the blood from the start to the finish in your heart, and I couldn't read a book, so she would read it to me. You go from this vein to this ventricle, this ventricle, this artery, this artery. I pass it.
And that's what I'm wondering because, I mean, I think it's obvious to everyone listening. It's pretty remarkable that you survived when so many did not that day. So in all this time where you're recovering, you got your eyes covered, you can't see anything, you're in a pretty helpless situation. Did you ever think that you would get married someday, that you'd have a daughter, that you'd have grandkids and great-grandkids?
Never even thought about it. All I thought about is getting healthy, get back on my feet, go to college. I really wanted to go to college. Because all my friends at Odo, you know, they came from pretty rich families. When I say rich, I mean they're better off than we were. And they're all going to college, and what am I going to do? There's no jobs in a town of 300 people. You got two gas stations, two grocery stores, a bank, the post office. That's it. I felt lonely, hoping someday to get back to normal.
And it was a good thing you went to college, not just because you had a great 30-year career as a teacher, but because that's where you met your wife.
I met my wife, and we were married 62 years before she died of dementia.
You want to tell us a story of how you met her over there?
We played cards at the Union. Neither one of us had much money. See, I was living off in the Navy, and we met. We played cards, bridge, and then we'd go from there. We might go to the shop. We'd order a Coke and two straws. Get ice cream. We get two spoons. Yeah. So it was very, very, very wonderful woman.
And I'm curious, as your career in education went on, did you ever bring up your war experience? Did you ever share that with anybody?
No, never. Kept quiet. You know, to this day, I don't belong to American Legion. I don't belong to VFW. I don't belong to Purple Heart.
Why not?
I don't like to be around people, and all they're talking about is war stories. I have my own, and I get tired of hearing the same. I don't like to hear war stories. Yeah. That's why I don't join those groups. I've had opportunities after opportunities. Sure. I'm sure they would help me get better, more benefits than I get, but I'm satisfied. Like I tell my wife, and she says, what'd you do with this? And I said, I don't want to talk about it.
And you keep your Purple Heart, the same one you got nearly 70 years ago, tucked away. Do you remember when they gave it to you? Was it a general that gave it to you, or how'd you get it?
I'll tell you how I got it. I didn't even know I had it. I was at the University of Iowa, and my mom called, and she says, guess what? I said, what? Some Navy people came to the house and they presented the Purple Heart to you. I didn't know I had it. So when I went home that weekend, I got to see the Purple Heart.
What does that mean to you?
It means that they gave me some credit for the time I spent and the parts of my life I gave up. It means a lot to me. They say I should have other medals, and I said, well, I don't care about it. My main thing is my health.
So I know you can't do this. It doesn't look possible, but if you could go down to the bottom of the ocean and find the wreckage of the Hornet, what would you try to get out of there? What went down with that ship that you wish you still had?
I like those pictures I had with Doolittle and the pictures I had with him, the pilots. Any souvenirs that I got when I was in Hawaii, there's not much I had. You know, being a rookie, a petty officer, you don't have many things.
So when I was asking Bob about that on this program in 2013, I had no idea, and of course neither did he, that the Hornet would be discovered here in 2019, that he would still be going strong, with technology allowing him to look at images of that sunken vessel from 3 miles deep, stirring more memories of long ago.
It does. It really does, because bringing that ship up, the first thing that comes to my mind is the kamikaze pilots that hit the tower, put the power out, and then that bomber hitting the bottom of it. And also brought my memories of Indianapolis. They tied it to the ship and tried to pull it out, but they couldn't do it. You know, out there you got to zigzag because they're out there dropping bombs or the fighters are coming in and spraying you. That's what we had to worry about when we were in the water, you know, waiting for a ship to come to pick you up.
Yeah.
So when they did pick us up, it's funny because I was on the destroyer. Mm-hmm. You go this way and this way and this way, and all that time they're trying to sew my eye up. It brings back a lot of good memories about the ship, too. You know, I joined before the war,
right?
In August of 41. After the boot camp, I was assigned to the Hornet in Northport, Virginia. We didn't have any guns, no pilots, no planes or anything. The war broke out. So it really brings back good memories.
Almost 77 years. You're one of the last guys left.
Yeah.
Who survived that day.
Mm-hmm.
tried.
What does it mean to you that someone took the time and effort to track it down and dive all the way down and find it and take those pictures?
Well, you know, it shows you that there are still people that are history buffs. You think that there's people that are still interested in those kind of things to bring back memories of different wars. It shows you that history goes on. Mm-hmm. You repeat, and they try to bring up remnants to prove that this actually really happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just read it out of a book. Yeah. Hey, here it is, right there.
Now that they found your ship, and they're not going to disturb it, it's a mm-hmm. tomb at the bottom of the ocean, but mm-hmm. is there something that's still on that ship that belongs to you?
Oh, you know, in my locker, you can't believe the number of pictures I took when we went through the Panama Canal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I took my wife back there when she was alive. I took every place I went, you know, that we could go to.
Yeah.
And like the Panama Canal, you know, where you had to raise the water because either one side's higher than the other side.
Right.
And then have those tugs tug you through.
Uh-huh.
Like in San Diego, we had pictures of, you know, I was too young to go to a bar.
Mm-hmm.
So I always went to the USOs. In San Diego, the Hotel Grant.
Uh-huh.
Beautiful. That was a USO for us down there.
So all those pictures of that are still in your locker?
Right? Still in my locker.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I had a lot.
Those pictures are still with the Hornet, replaced perhaps now in his mind by the new photos of a mighty ship frozen in time. One thing that hasn't changed in 77 years, Bob's gratitude for having survived that harrowing ordeal.
I know God was looking over me. And number two is I was in the right place at the right time, especially down there when only 12 of us come out alive out of 35. I must have been standing in the place where I got hit but didn't get killed. And those other, they were in the wrong place. And I feel very fortunate. Here in the United States, we got men and women who will stand up and fight for our people. And that people that didn't go in the service, when they see a service woman or a service man, they shake their hands or say, thank you. To think people who didn't want to go or didn't get a chance to go, but they are so grateful for people who do.
And Bob will experience that at a whole new level next month when he flies to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. If you'd like to welcome him home from that special journey, be in Fresno, California on Thursday, April 11th, when he and 70 other veterans land at the airport. We're about out of time, but I did mention I'd have one more note on the idea of this program holding educational value. And thanks to my friends at CaliforniaStreaming.org and the efforts of a dedicated Girl Scout named Katie Chen, 250 episodes of Hometown Heroes are now accessible for more than 330,000 California students in an online database. We'll talk more about that on a future installment of Hometown Heroes. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, go into your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.